my sincere pleasure to introduce and have a chance to talk to Dennis Leary. Dennis is often called a quote-unquote Feldenkrais trainer. Works in Feldenkrais training worldwide and has been doing so for over 30 years. But, you know, I don't really think the words Feldenkrais trainer covers his many skills and many talents that he has. Dennis has written dozens of articles on the Feldenkrais method, on judo, learning, epistemology, Buddhism, many of which have been translated into multiple languages and can be found on Dennis's website at semiophysics.com. And Dennis has had direct experience and relationships with many people that I think Feldenkrais practitioners will be, at the very least, familiar with. People like Milton Erickson, Francisco Varela, Heinz von Forster. I believe Dennis has met and worked with John Grinder and Richard Bandler and some of his students, and, of course, spent many years working with Moshe Feldenkrais. Dennis, is that a fairly good summation to begin with?
Yeah, that's good.
Now, my understanding, and I believe I got this from your website, is that you work with Moshe in Israel, and if I'm not mistaken, that was prior to the San Francisco training, is that right?
No, it was right after. Well, actually, it was about a year after.
Okay. So how did you meet Moshe, I mean, and decide to work with him?
Well, there are many ways to answer that, but essentially, I came across his name in a little Rolfing pamphlet that the Rolfers used to give out, and his was the only name that she mentioned, and so it set up, who's this, you know, and then there was a workshop, I heard about it, asked about it, and then there was a workshop in San Francisco given by Ruthie Alon in 72, and I did that and had his book at the time, so I actually began writing to Moshe in 72, and he answered, and so we had a little correspondence, and then he came over in 73, and did a summer-long training in Berkeley. So I was going to be in that, and then I decided to work with Tarthing Tulku Rinpoche during the day, and I'd work with Moshe two nights a week in Berkeley for the summer.
So what do you mean work with Moshe two nights a week?
Well, he had a public class, and so I did classes, you know, it's like basic ATM classes with him. But there was a woman who'd studied with him in Israel who introduced me training site in Berkeley, and since we had correspondence there, he knew who I was and he knew my interest. There was some history there, and I'm glad in a way that I didn't do that summer training, because not many of those people actually went on to continue studying with Moshe.
Interesting. So, I mean, you started the training like in the second year, is that what you mean?
No, our training started in 75. So this was going to be a training, but turned out not to be a training. It was just a summer-long experience with Moshe.
One thing I'm curious about, I don't know much about your life around that time. So, like, I mean, what were you doing? I mean, just like you were 20-something that was going to school, or you were, you know, I mean, what was your life like?
Well, see, around that time, I was finishing up my studies at Sonoma State, which I majored in filmmaking and psychology. And I was also taking classes at the Institute of Asian Studies in San Francisco, and that's where I met my Kent Roshi. So that was around 70, 71, 72. And then I moved to the city in San Francisco in 1973 and was in a kind of a quasi-Gurdjieffian group. And I was working mainly as a graphic artist. That's what I did to make money. So I worked mainly for a vitamin company, designing labels. And then we did freelance work for the community, public events, things like that, you know.
So did you grow up in that part of the country?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm, Marysville, north of Sacramento, so I was a farm boy.
It's probably a subdivision at this point, and it's probably a bunch of condos or something.
No, it's still farm. Oh, really?
Nobody,
yeah, you really wouldn't want to live out there. It's pretty forbidding.
So as I've mentioned in this podcast and in our emails, you know, I get the impression that you, like Moshe, you pull from a number of traditions, and that you don't just study something. You mean, like reading a book, you'll very often go out and try to just work directly with someone whoever interests you,
correct.
Whoever you're interested in, which I have a great deal of respect for. And you obviously have a huge amount of experience as a Feldenkrais trainer and as a practitioner. So I have a couple of related questions that I want to ask you. And what I'm going to do is throw them out there, and you can answer them however you want or in whatever way you want. And I'm really curious if you can tell me some areas or ideas, perhaps, in which you think Moshe might have missed the boat. He may have actually been unclear in his ideas or in his thinking. And given that you've edited some of the early transcripts from San Francisco, et cetera, I'm wondering if there were new ideas that Moshe was formulating but never really had the opportunity to develop. So that's one question, obviously, and it's kind of a big question. Conversely, I'm where do you think that we as a community have missed the boat? For example, are there important ideas of Moshe's that are not included in the training or in our workshops, maybe threads that were not picked up on or developed or lost? And lastly, I sometimes wonder if the needs of creating a quote-unquote profession and as teach a greater number of students, if somehow that shaped the work in ways that are not entirely clear or conscious, say to the trainers or even the new students in the field. So we can get at least a few minutes out of that, right?
Yeah, I think we can get a few. First of all, with a person like Feldenkrais, and I say a person like Feldenkrais, what I mean is somebody who originated or brought forth or brought into the world something that's really unique. And I don't think anybody will disagree that Feldenkrais' work is unique. My mental furniture articles are an attempt to show some of his influences and some of the scaffolding for his thinking and for the kinds of experience that he brought to bear on developing the work. So like any originator, there's always going to be rough areas, right? So you're going to have to pick up some threads, think some things were more important than others, and develop in a certain way based upon your own idiosyncrasies. And so I think Feldenkrais was very clear that he had idiosyncrasies, that he had his own neuroses, his own limitations in a way. In fact, when you mentioned Milton Erickson, he and Milton Erickson were going to get together. And Moshe had asked Milton Erickson, Milton Erickson said, well, why would you want to get together? And Moshe said, well, look, you know, I don't know when I'm passing on my work how much of it is me and how much of it is my work, and I'd like to be able to just pass on what is really germane and essential to my work and leave out things that aren't. And so Erickson felt that was a very good request on Moshe's part. Unfortunately, they never got to meet that second time. So that didn't happen. So when we think about Feldenkrais' work, we think, okay, well, there's awareness through movement, functional integration, and then what are they? And so one of the difficulties, I think, in thinking about Feldenkrais' work or thinking about research or thinking about teaching it or trying to categorize it is, first of all, I don't think anybody's ever figured out what it is we're doing. So, you know, if you study botany, then you have an object of study. You have, you know, plants. Or if you have anatomy, you have a certain object. You have something that's delineated that you study, and people, by agreement, becomes a practice. So, for example, anatomy done by anatomists, they use certain terminology and it means certain things to them based upon the practice of being an anatomist. So we in the Feldenkrais world say the skeletal contact or things like that, we take up those terms in a different way. So they're not the same. It's not the same domain, phenomenological domain as it is for an anatomist. Same thing when we talk about the nervous system. It's not the same nervous system that a neurologist or a neuroscientist would deal with. It's just not.
Well, it sounds like there's definitions of a nervous system in a person. There's that sort of abstract, and then there's also doing this in action, which is what we're doing as Feldenkrais.
Right, yeah. Right. So what I'm saying is that when you're in a training program, like I say, as a student, you come in and you have any number of reasons for being there. And so with that comes a certain set of expectations about what the work is. Right. So, you know, are training programs trade schools? Is it a wisdom tradition? Is it science? What is it? Right. And I think all those things are part of our work, but that doesn't define it. So getting back to Feldenkrais, I think by bringing it into the world the way in which he did, in terms of functional integration, awareness through movement, then where I think, because your first question is where I think he went wrong or where he might have gone wrong or gone astray or something like that. That was your question, right? I mean, that was the first one?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, when you look at historically when Feldenkrais worked with his first group, he told them, you know, don't ask me any questions that aren't related to what I do on the table. Like what you see me do on the table, that's what the work is about. And so he mainly demonstrated they worked with him, he worked with them, it was a small group, so it was very intimate and very personal. And then it wasn't until he met Milton Erickson that he realized that his work really comprised how somebody heard about him, how they walked into the room, whether they're with somebody or not with somebody, what they looked like. In other words, the world from which they came and the world they're going back into, and how they presented themselves or didn't present themselves. And so there was a whole lot that he dealt with that wasn't to do with just the techniques of functional integration. And so then he realized at that point that he had subtracted from his teaching those things which are very, very, very essential. And to understand, in other words, to understand the effectiveness that he personally was able to get working with his students.
Wow. Now, he must be a quick study because he only met with Erickson one time.
But he, when I say he met Milton Erickson, I mean it both literally and also figuratively, because Margaret Mead had tried to get Moshe to meet Milton Erickson and Gregory Bateson too. And so he met them through Margaret and Gregory. And then also Paul Rubin, who was in my training, had mentioned to Moshe about Milton Erickson. He kept saying, well, to Paul, well, what I'm doing, it's not hypnosis. And then when he met Milton Erickson, he realized, well, what Milton is doing isn't what he would call hypnosis either, you know. So what Moshe would call hypnosis either, it was something else. And I think that they, in other words, look at it like this. When Milton Erickson talked about the unconscious, he had a very dynamic definition for it. He said, look, it's the repository of all your previous learning states, learning processes, and things learned. And so when Moshe talked about the nervous system, it was very, very analogous. Right? So when we talk about the nervous system, we're really talking about a kind of a practice about learning or development, however you want to say it, and about developing autonomy, about developing ability to live in this world. And so that was you know, so in that sense, there's a lot of similarity in terms of the aim. There were certain differences in practice that leads to two different disciplines.
You were at both trainings, right, San Francisco and Amherst?
Yes.
Okay, so in the Amherst training, when you start the Amherst training, and Moshe is teaching differently, he's telling more stories. I can't remember who told me this at one point. I think it was one of the original Israelis was like, we came to Amherst, and, you know, Moshe was teaching, and we thought, who is this guy teaching? He seems so different.
Uh-huh.
Is that an accurate characterization, or is that too much?
Well, it might be accurate for them, because they spent so much time studying with him. The time in which they'd studied with him was long. And so we just had from 75, being the training program, or 72, 73 for some of us who worked with him earlier. So we didn't have all that much time. To Amherst was 6-8 years, right? So I didn't see that much difference. The difference mainly was size. You know, there were 200 and, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 people at Amherst.
20 or 30 in San Francisco?
No, 65 in San Francisco. Let me tell you a little about the history of the Amherst training. So when Mark Reese and I were in Israel, we're trying to get Moshe to do an advanced training for us. I mean, to really say, okay, what we've seen here, being here for these 6 months or so, what we've seen in terms of your functional integration and talking with you, we've really seen something that we didn't see in San Francisco. And let's do an advanced training to bring that out, to deepen all of our experiences of Feldenkrais. He said, no, I want to do a new training. I want hundreds of people. And so we argued back and forth about, well, the value of one way or another. Most people don't know, Mark Reese was an incredible, tenacious debater and arguer. And so he and Moshe would just argue and argue and argue. And then after about a week, Moshe came back and said, okay, I'm going to do this training, and this is how it's going to be, which was basically on the terms that Mark and I had wanted. But he said, look, he said, I don't want to do an advanced training because there'll be a small amount of people. So I want to do a large training. So our question was, why do you want to do a large training? And he says, because, he said, do you know who Mabel Todd is? And we said, yeah, of course. And he said, well, if I get one Mabel Todd out of all the people that I trained, out of your training, my original group, and out of the people at Amherst, he said, then I'll feel my life's work is justified. Because Mabel Todd, unlike all the people who developed the sensory awareness work in Europe, Mabel Todd, on her own, developed in a very unique way of thinking about movement and action and meaning, human value. And he said, so if there's one person that comes along and goes, oh, yeah, well, yeah, Moshe, this is great, but, you know, you didn't think about this, right? And he said, takes it to that next level. He said, then I'll feel that what I've done and what I've brought into the world, he said, which is just in its infancy, will really be able to develop. And he said, so I just feel that could be better accomplished by having larger numbers. So in that sense, he says, when you come to the Amherst training, he says, you'll watch how I do it, and you'll understand what I'm doing at this point, and you'll understand where I'm going with this. Then, he says, that will address what you want, but also it will give us many more practitioners and give you many more colleagues with whom you can interact.
Wow.
You know?
And so were you guys also having separate meetings at night, you and some of his students talking about the training, the process?
In Amherst?
Yes.
in Amherst? Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of San Francisco students at Amherst, and we did, and we met with each other, and we met with the Israelis. I mean, yes, more informal than formal. But David Burson and Mark and I would talk about this, you know, endlessly. And then when we started developing our own trainings, we went back and looked at San Francisco, looked at Amherst, and say, well, how are we going to carry on? How are we going to do it? You know, so that was how we.
Yeah. So let me ask you again: where was something that Moshe might have missed the boat on?
I feel that there is. Again, let me back up to Israel. So when I was in Israel, I gave Moshe my copy of Francisco Varela's book, The Principles of Biological Autonomy, and I left it with him. And then when he came to, then I brought him to Boulder in 1980, and when he met Varela, he told Varela, he said, look, your book was one of the more important two or three books I've read in my life. So how many books has Moshe read? And Francisco felt, you know, really good. And then Moshe said, but of course, he said, you wrote two books. He said, you wrote one book that's essential, that's really, really something novel, something new in the world, and then you wrote one to try to impress your colleagues. And so after that, almost all of Varela's writings were very clearly in one domain or the other, either very technical and very formal or more philosophical and more from his own experience. So he segregated them later on, and I think it was, you know, probably from that meeting. But anyway, so the ideas in Varela and Maturana and Hein von Forster and the so-called Santiago School of Neuroepistemology, it's a really profound revisioning of biology and cognition. And essential to that is their concept of what language or languaging is. And so language isn't verbal, isn't words, isn't communication. It's about the kinds of actions that interactions that we have and interacting together, so that it's sort of like you're in a field. You're already interacting in a certain way when somebody comes into a field, into your field of attention, into your domain. So you're already interacting, and then as you coordinate your actions, you have a sense that there's some agreement, some trust, and some basis from which to proceed. Then the coordination of actions is what they call languaging. In other words, that when you're coordinating your actions, you're also signifying to the person, that people, okay, we know we're doing this dance together. And then the third order is the coordination, which gives you some sense of observer, right? So now you're observing this, and you can simulate those interactions within your own nervous system, but you're still in the social domain when you do it. And the fourth order is when you can say, I'm doing this, I'm dancing, and you understand what that means because you're at that level of coordination of actions. So when Moshe would talk about language, he had really a sense of the Korzybski model, which is just so pervasive, which is the idea that the map is not the territory, the menu is not the meal, the word is not the thing. And that seems very self-evident. You don't eat the menu. And if you walk on a map, you don't feel like you climbed any mountains. And so it just seems self-evident that that's the way it is. But when Varela and Maturana, especially Maturana, when he shows that the basis for language is the ability to enact it, in other words, to do language, that doing language rather than the content of language, what we think of as a content, that's where the idea of language or languaging takes place.
Yeah, I saw the word structural coupling come up a lot in their use of language.
Yeah, structural coupling means essentially that when any two organisms, or it could be an organism in the environment, when they, what Varela calls, drift together, in other words, when there's some history of that linkage, it's what Bateson, I think you're familiar with Bateson, what he called the survival of the fit, not the fittest, but the fit. So the structural coupling was the fit of organism to environment, or organism to other organisms, so that when that fit drifts together, there's historical coupling, structural coupling, and that changes the actual structure of the organism, structure in the Varela sense, not in our sense, but structure in the Varela sense. So when you start to think about language as a practice, then you, well, let's just jump ahead. So because one of your other questions was about training and trainers, right? And so what Varela would say, what he did say was, when you think of a carpenter and you say, well, what are the attributes that make a carpenter? You could inventory them. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, what you see is when a carpenter picks up a hammer and they begin hammer, or they pick up a nail. They enact, they bring forth carpentry, right? In other words, mm-hmm. as they're doing it, you see carpentry happen, right?
Right.
Same thing with martial artists. You see somebody, like, how do you understand Tai Chi, or how do you understand Aikido or something? You see it because the certain people bring it forth, and you see the actions, then you can understand it. So when we think about certifying trainers, just to me, the idea of the training board, it's a good idea in terms of trying to have somebody have a rite of passage. So in other words, like, when you have a black belt test in Aikido, you always have somebody at least in a second degree or third degree black belt or above as part of the examination committee, right?
Mm-hmm.
And why? Because a person has to understand all the distinctions you need to make to bring forth Aikido. And let's say you have on your committee somebody who was just beginning. They wouldn't understand. They wouldn't know how to see the distinctions that one makes to bring it forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think that it's good to have community input. I think that the certification of trainers should be left to trainers and long-term trainers. And that doesn't mean it would constrain the amount of trainers. In fact, it would actually generate a lot more trainers. Because if three or four people said, look, whoever it happens to be, Kathy James, who's in California, like, we think she's ready, then what do you need beyond that? Because we see that not only can she make the distinctions, but she can bring forth those distinctions in other people. So therefore, she is training, right? But she hasn't gone through a certain process whereby she can say, I'm a trainer, right? So she can say, I can make these distinctions, right? And so in that sense, you know, Feldenkrais has an example in judo, and we have that example in other martial arts, and you have the example in other fields. So in that sense, I just feel like the understanding of what it is to make the distinctions in our practice that we make, it takes a while to understand those.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. What we have now, though, is a layer of bureaucracy on top of that. Because, I mean, I think a lot of people, well, myself included, don't really understand the process of becoming a trainer. So it's trainer's input plus the tabs.
Look, if you can't make those distinctions,
uh-huh.
to get back to what I said, you need a list, you need an inventory, and then you need to have people address that inventory, right? It's not just a layer of bureaucracy. It's just a layer of standardization,
mm-hmm.
right? So everybody has
is that what we have?
Yes, what we have now, right? And I just feel like it takes too long. If you're a steady practitioner for 10 years, because what we have now is 5 years, you can become an assistant trainer, and then 10 years, become a trainer, or less,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. You know, why aren't there more trainers?
I mean, historically, since it's been 10, 15, 20 years since the project.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many people now, so many of my students from, you know, from the trainings have been, well, one of them, Richard is, but many of those people are not, and could be. So what I'm saying is that when Moshe, when the guild was developing, I was in Israel, and he told me that he had talked to Werner Erhard about forming a guild, an organization. And Werner had told him, in his experience, he had tried to get the best people to set up his organization. He said there wasn't an organization in the history of the world that at some point didn't start working counter to the intentions upon which it was set up.
Yeah, amen to that.
Right?
Sure.
And so in that sense, you're just going to find that that's what happens, right? The things just keep moving on, and people don't take care of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting, just frame of reference I haven't really had before, because, you know, in my own little delusional world here, I think, why aren't there more trainers? I would think, well, maybe there's not enough of a demand for it. I don't know how accurate that is. But we don't think, or at least I don't think, of sort of the larger structures around that. I think, well, maybe, you know, trainers out there dragging their feet and don't want to be competitors or something like that. But, you know,
that's not it at all. See, in the beginning, when we set up the training board, we set it up for a particular reason. Because, do you want to know this stuff? I mean, is this okay?
Yeah, this is great.
So,
I want to hear this.
There was a Feldenkrais Foundation, which ran the first, I think, three trainings after Moshe passed away. And
they were using the videos, right?
They were using the videos. And so we met in San Francisco, Jerry, Anad, Bonnie Humiston,
So a lot of this history is new to me, so I'll stop you here and there. So there's a foundation that was set up by Moshe in Israel, right, with some of his lawyers.
Yeah.
When you say we get together, you and Not Banyel and others, are you a part of that foundation, or are you
a
group?
No. We're part of the guild. We're just kind of a guild committee at that point. So Jerry was basically Moshe's confidant the last, you know, 3-4 years or whatever, Moshe's life,
mm-hmm.
or 5 years, whatever it was, and Not was living here in the Bay Area, and so we organized it, and yeah, we met, and it took a while for it to establish it, and we all had different ideas, and essentially what we decided at that time was not to make the guild responsible for training. In other words, the guild wouldn't run training, that we would farm it out, let it be more entrepreneurial. And so whoever could want to start a training would meet certain fundamental criteria and then go from there.
Hmm.
And one of them was me having 4 trainers, so that there wasn't like one particular perspective, you know, that we just...
Yeah,
like,
that's one of the things I love about the trainings, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And that was mainly Jerry's idea.
Uh-huh.
So then the trainings sort of evolved out of that. The foundation owned the videos, and Anat and I were going to do our own trainings. I was going to do one in San Francisco or one in the Bay Area, and she was doing one in New York City, and we were planning them, and they wanted a certain amount of money for the videos, in which we said, okay, well, we'll do that, and then they said they wanted more money.
Hmm.
And it wasn't Moshe, it was somebody else. So we just said, we talked to Bonnie Humison, we talked to the guild, we said, look, we're going to give them a deadline, and past that deadline, we want to be able to not have to use the videos, because we're not going to get shaken down for this. The deadline came and went, and so, you know, Anat and I looked at each other, and she said, are you ready for this? And I said, yeah, I guess so. And so that's when we started doing trainings without the videos. We thought, okay, it's probably more honoring what Moshe was thinking about anyway. Not we didn't use his content. A friend of mine found out about this, a practitioner, and she phoned up and said, well, you know, you got to have Moshe in your training programs. And I said, well, if you mean the videos of Moshe, we will use him, you know, selectively here and there. But, you know, I had to tell me the bearer of bad news, but he's gone. You know, he's dead, right? So we took off from there, and that's sort of how it developed. And then certain qualifications for assistant trainer and educational director and things sort of evolved. They just sort of evolved ad hoc, right, as things went along.
See, what you're describing is, I mean, to me, that's organic development.
It was very organic.
Yeah, I've been doing this work for a number of years. The videos aren't available to me, or I'm tired of using them. I'm going to put myself out there and let's do it. I mean, to a certain extent, forget about the method for a second from my point of view and say, it's me or it's you developing as a person, as a trainer, as an imparter of ideas. Sounds pretty exciting to me.
And so several times what we've tried to do is we've tried to split the certification of trainers away from the tabs, and so the trainers themselves would be responsible for certifying or assistant trainers and trainers, and the guilds themselves could also say, okay, look, let's say you're Australian or South American, and you really want a South American or somebody to be an assistant, and you say, okay, well, we want so many people to be, you know, native Australians or native South Americans to be on it, right? So then you specify who you want. Why not make a rule like that too? You know, so sure, it's fine. But what initially the idea was to have varied opinions and varied experiences in the training. The way it's evolved is, of course, it would have evolved this way, is that as we become more trainers and more assistants, people tended to hire, if not people who agreed with them, at least people who they liked or trusted.
Sure.
And so there's little cliques, and I don't mean that in any negative sense. I think it's just that's an organic development too, right? It's like family, so we're everybody's cousins. And,
yeah.
And so you'll have Jerry's group, and you know who people kind of Jerry hires, and people hire Jerry, and then somebody else, and you know who they hire, and myself, and Elizabeth and David, and people like that. We have our own. And that's just because you work with people and you know how to trust them, you know. And so
I was just reading an article about Darwin and the Galapagos Islands, and you know, little islands get separated and develop in different species. So
exactly right, and yet they're related, right? So that's the thing.
Yeah.
So and I really think that just was an inevitable development, and it should be that way. I mean, again, from a Darwinian sense, we don't know what constitutes a perfect training. There's never been one. There probably never will be one. And some people will be in the worst, you know, by general consensus, could be the worst training situation possible, and there's still great people come out of it. And the other ones, people will provide everything you could possibly imagine for the students' learning, and people just drift through it and, you know, and
it'll fade away.
Yeah, fade away, right? So there's not any particular, no guarantee what's going to work. So the more experiments we have, then the better it is, I think. And I think it's happening that way anyway, because you'll find, even though outside the guild you have Yohanan and Mia and not Russell doing his what he does, some people doing things, you know. So no, it's continuing. It's just continuing on its own, momentum there.
I'm not 100% sure I want to go down this route. I wasn't planning on either, since we're sort of on the topic. Did Moshe have an opinion on the service marks? Was that part of the early guild? Did that come later?
Well, the service marks were... no, Moshe didn't have much of an opinion on that. You know, Bonnie Humiston's the person to talk to about that.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to talk to her later in the week, as a matter of fact.
Essentially, the service marks, and we were largely against them to begin with, but service marks worked to this end. Let's say you've been in a training program, you spent a lot of time and money learning Feldenkrais. Somebody goes to a workshop, comes back to your little town in Idaho or Indiana or whatever, and sets himself up as a Feldenkrais person, right? Well, you know, I mean, there's no protection for you. There's nothing that designates you from them, right? So the service mark was set up and sort of a formalization of what it meant to go through a training and all that machinery which the real world requires, right, to be able to set up an organization as a profit and non-profit. I mean, there's all kinds of legalities that go into those processes. And Michael Purcell has been, you know, waging that battle for years. So, you know, he's another person to talk to, and Bonnie. There is a sense, for me, I don't care. People come to me because I've been doing this for 30-some-odd years, so I don't care one way or the other. But for somebody else who's just really invested a lot of time and energy into learning it, then there is a practical value in having a service mark.
Yeah, and having that differentiation.
Yeah, exactly.
Although at some point, open source models in the software community.
Right.
I would love it if there were 10,000 people, 100,000 people that started doing the Feldenkrais method, even if it was some bizarre approximation. You know, they're out there experimenting and weren't getting it right, and they're ready. They come to you with guilt, or you know.
Yeah. I mean, that happens anyway, right? There's no question that happens. Some woman wrote Feldenkrais when I was in Israel, and she'd read his book, and she was in Arizona or somewhere, and she was a nurse of some sort, I think. And she was working with these patients. The work she was doing, where she said, look, I couldn't describe it better, and it sounds like, from what I can read, it sounds like she really nailed it, you know? So, I mean, so it is possible. Like we say, you know, you never know.
Yeah. So my question from earlier was, you still want to answer it, if you're interested, is, you know, where do you think we've missed the boat as a community? Are there ideas that we haven't picked up?
Right? Well, again, you know, what is, you know, what's training for?
Yeah.
Who's it for?
Yeah.
And so if it's a trade school, then it's valid to evaluate whether how many people actually practice. You know, people aren't practicing, whatever, right? Well, okay, but that's not my understanding. Other people may have it that way. It's not my understanding. My understanding is, you know, people come into a training program, some of them very enthusiastic, wanting to become practitioners, and then after a year or two, decide, you know, I really want to play piano, or I really want to develop software, or I really want to go back to school, you know? And so to me, that's successful, right?
Sure.
That they've gone on and helped them clarify. Other people come in the training, and they say, I just want to kind of dabble. I don't want to do it, you know? And after a year or two, they go, hey, I'm kind of good at this. I really like this. And so then they do become practitioners. So it's really hard to say, you know, well let's segregate it and have trade school only or development only. I mean, it's kind of interesting to throw everybody into the mix and just have it like it is. And then you know, the different sorts of family relations that are doing Feldenkrais trainings, some are a little more technically oriented, and some are a little more experientially oriented, and yet good practitioners in terms of functional integration and awareness of movement come out of all the different trainings. There's not one that doesn't produce, you know.
Yeah, sure.
If that's what somebody wants to do, that can happen.
And again, it's that process of sort of throwing everything to the mix. It's an organic sort of development process.
Yeah, but the thing is this. So Feldenkrais said many times. And when he would say it in training programs, or he would say it in workshops, because I traveled around with him and watched him give workshops, and he said, look, this feeling you have now after the lesson, this gracefulness that you feel, this lightness, this sense of groundedness, whatever, this feeling you have, which is so wonderful, right? He said, this is trivial to what's possible with this work. And I think that, for me, what people have accepted is just producing that effect and not taking people deeply into how that effect is produced, or how that, or what brings forth that sense of whatever buoyancy or lightness, or that sense, that different sense of self. And I think that's what hasn't been developed. And I think it was there in Feldenkrais, but I think he didn't have the tools like Varela or Peirce or some of the other tools to be able to think that through in a way and develop that also. Here's one thing. So when you think of a scan, you're lying on your back,
mm-hmm.
and somebody says, in your field of attention, they give you an address, and this address is your left heel, right? So instantly your attention goes to your left heel. Notice, can you do that? Yes, okay. Some people can. Most people can. Now feel the right heel, okay? Now what's the difference between the two? And the differences can take many forms. And so then you elucidate the forms: higher, lower, heavier, lighter, darker, rougher, smoother, whatever it happens to be, right? And you set up a continuum, not either or, but this kind of continuum. Now, this is familiar, right? Right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, but where is the difference? And so one's higher or lower. Where does that difference exist, right? You see, that difference isn't in the left foot. The difference is in the right foot, right? It's in the perceptual judgment, higher or lower, left or right, right? That is a relationship. It's a pure relationship. It doesn't have any physicality in and of itself. Yet it relates physicality. It relates a certain level of attention to ourselves. And it relates it, it separates it, and it connects, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that sense of relation, you feel a proximal or a contiguous relationship, left and right, and you feel the difference. So you feel a spatial difference, correct?
Correct, spatial
okay.
relationship, sure.
And so you scan all throughout yourself, your contact with the floor, the chair, whatever you're doing. And then you go through whatever lesson you're doing, and at some point you check back in, and at the end you come back. So now you have not only the sense of the difference between left and right, right? You also have the sense of difference between now and then, right? So you have a temporal relationship to
sure.
yourself.
So you're layering another distinction on top of it.
That's right. Yeah, but it's a contiguity in time and a contiguity in space. So this moment now related to that first moment, right? So that's what we need to get people in the process of sensing and perceiving and cognizing from the beginning, and the particular way we do it, with these distinctions, these relational distinctions that separate and join. And so then you see, okay, at the end, now it's a different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what happens in that half hour, 45 minutes to an hour? In other words, if you were just to lie on the floor, right, and let's say your life has a certain trajectory, lying on the floor, and you get up, how different will your life be if you don't do anything? You just lie and you're resting. You feel a little more restful, and maybe you do something a little different, but essentially you're back into your life as it was, right?
Right.
But if you lie on the floor and you start to make these distinctions, right, and you begin to shift the spatial and temporal relations, in other words, the very punctuation of your field of attention, right? In other words, when you're changing the punctuation, you know, when you change punctuation in a sentence, it can really change the meaning. So you're changing the punctuation, or you're adding content which wasn't there either, right? So you
sure.
so this is really different. So when we're thinking about the idea of self-development or self-control or autonomy or whatever, it's in that really micro level, right? So you studied some Erickson and some NLP, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So now when you're lying on the floor, and you're saying, you can say you feel your body's contact with the floor. Well, in Feldenkrais, that's implicit. How else could you feel it? So we automatically just get rid of that. We say, okay, feel your contact with the floor. So now you are in contact with the floor. And what is you, how do you define you? Because of the spatial set of distinctions, right? This, this mosaic that you feel, right? And then you go through, and then now, look, you're different, right? So what happens is you set up these indices for your field of experience, and they have certain addresses. Like when you say 2 o'clock on a clock, automatically if you have 2 o'clock, you have all the other numbers of the clock,
mm-hmm.
right? All right. Sure. And so implicitly you have the rest of the clock, and you have direction, clockwise, counterclockwise, right? Same thing when you say foot. I mean, automatically you have an address. I mean, foot implies part of a leg, part of yourself, you know, so on and so forth, right? So the sense of yourself gets redistributed. Now it gets redistributed. I wrote a paper on this one, Erickson. When people have talked about Erickson and metaphor, in fact, Erickson used what they call metonymical distinctions. So he would say, a man came to see, are you still with me?
Yeah, I'm still here. Okay. A metonymical, that's a new word to me, so I'm glad you brought it up.
Okay, so he says, a man came to me today. Doesn't say what kind of man, right? So automatically, you're filling in content, right? You're thinking, okay, not a woman, man, right? And you're thinking you might have some generic man there, right? Then he says, 46 years old, okay? Married, 6 kids, right? The eldest 2 in jail. The wife works 2 jobs, right? So in other words, he doesn't say, you know, the guy's a slacker, right? He doesn't give you an interpretation. As you go along, you end up filling it in. And what happens when you're stringing along a temporal train, these metonymical indices or indexes for experience, it's begging for interpretation. Right? It's begging for a container. So when you look at aphasia, there are different kinds of aphasia. There's metonymical, metaphorical kinds of aphasia. In other words, people say, well, anyway.
What you're describing is, say that was Erickson, I could almost think of it as an FI or an ATM as well.
Exactly.
You have to become actively involved in creating.
Right. So in other words, when you string along a certain period of time without giving meaning, without, as the person giving the awareness and movement lesson, or functional integration, without saying this is what it means, the person starts to develop content for it, starts to develop meaning for it. And because of the reach of a lesson, because of the structure of the lesson, it's a very, very deep experience. It can be very superficial in terms of content or very deep in terms of content. So that's why you don't specify content. And then by the end, people have had to at least fill in, if not reinterpret, their sense of themselves as they've traveled through the lesson, right? So that when they get up off the floor, they get up off the table or out of the chair, whatever they're doing the lesson in, the trajectory of their life is slightly different, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe radically different, right? And
sure.
There's all kinds of, people have all kinds of experiences like that. So what I'm saying is that process whereby the set of impressions, the kind of imprint, self-imprint we would make to be ourselves, temporally and spatially at one moment in time, and then how it is later, that's a kind of a signature for many, many kinds of experiences, but we recognize it in Feldenkrais because we're direct in terms of we're enacting something, we're moving something, we're expanding our field of attention, we're working in such a way that's familiar with it. But what exactly is happening to allow that framework to take hold and for us to be able to feel comfortable with it, to move with it in that direction? Right? And so if those indices weren't our own, if that meaning wasn't our own, we wouldn't change, we wouldn't move on, right?
Okay. Sure.
Are you with me there?
Yeah, that's pretty intense.
So now when we think of a training program, I'm going to make a leap here. We think of a training program. When I have an assistant in the training program, each moment of the training program, each lesson in the training program is designed to bring that group. You find the center of gravity of that group, and you move that center of gravity just a little bit forward, right? And the center of gravity meaning understanding, sense of development, the involvement, right? So you move them forward. And so when we're looking for what an assistant trainer can do, what we assume a trainer can do, is that they can, in their own way, move that whole group forward, move everybody forward. And when somebody doesn't do that, in other words, if they have their own shtick, if they're trying to sell themselves, or they're insecure in certain ways, the group will actually fall back, right? Or at least not progress. And then the job of the trainer or whatever is to then, now you have to make up, right? And you can't force that. So it's you see that person that can't bring forth that distinction within the individuality of the group. Each group's got his own group mind, so he has to work within the group, and you're part of that.
Yeah, or right? At least they haven't been able to do it yet.
Right, haven't been able to do it yet. Exactly. And so that's part of the apprenticeship, is being able to do that so that you know, if you're out of the room for 5 days, you know that group will be 5 days progressed whether you're there or not, right? And so, again, we're looking at these kinds of scales of frequency and amplitude in terms of kinds of experiences that we have, right?
Okay.
Make sense? So now, in San Francisco, Moshe says, look, you've done this on one side, and you felt the difference, and now this difference has knit itself into a lot of separate parts. Now you feel the sense of this unified movement. Now we're going to think this through to the other side. And so you think it through, and you've done this, and everybody's done this, where you think it through, and to one degree or another of success, and you transfer it to the other side. So in San Francisco, he says, look, being able to understand and interact with this temporal ordering of yourself, we said when you're able to snip out and then put in a different ordering and be able to do that, he said, all I can say is the kind of light that shines that's unlike anything that anybody can tell you about, right? He said all the great, you know, mystics and philosophers have talked about this. So he makes this little mention in San Francisco. And so that kind of attention, paying attention to oneself, self-observing, what the consequences of self-observing could be, those are kinds of things I think that are not so well understood generally throughout the community. In other words, I think a lot of people may have those experiences, they may not have the experiences, but it's understanding how to have those experiences that I think is part and parcel to every lesson that we do.
Yeah, something that, you know, as you've been talking the last few minutes, I've stood up and I've been walking around, and I feel I have like a new distinction internally. I'm not sure I could talk about it at this
mm-hmm.
point. One thing that's been on my mind, if I can switch maybe just a little bit, in terms of Moshe's experience,
yeah,
was this sense of sort of recreating himself every so often by dint of, you know, being a Jew in Russia, being in
uh-huh.
Israel, being in France, learning multiple languages. And I wonder about that in relation to the development of the method and his ideas. It seems somehow very important to me.
What seems relevant to you?
It just seems like for an aware person or someone like him who was, you know, growing and developing and learning, it seems like you get a chance, an opportunity to just recreate yourself anew.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't specifically focusing on movement. I mean, obviously the Feldenkrais method is not about movement.
Right.
But I really fascinated about having that different sense of yourself from having those experiences. It's almost like you talk about continuity through time, like suddenly being able to look back at where you were 5 years ago, speaking in a different language, different culture, different customs. I like to think of it almost as having, I mean, obviously you're the same person, but different configurations of self.
Yeah, Yeah, I think one of the things is that when people think of an identity, they're thinking as some sort of singularity, right? And so, and this was in which you wrote, and you're onto something really important, which is when you have a singularity of identity, then people know who and where you are and what to do with you and to you. When your identity you're capable of multiplicities of identity, Richard Bandler said schizophrenia wasn't enough personalities to deal with the modern world, right? Which he would know, but you know, you need multiple personality, but in the sense of being able to face the world and generate different sense of self based upon the context, right? And yet there has to be an underlying sense of continuity with yourself. And so I think part of what Feldenkrais had, which allowed him to be so sane in so many different contexts, he had to know himself and feel really deep comfort. Not, I mean, like in a, you know, kind of hyper conscious way, but just in the sense that he was, you know, he lived in his nanchin and her tandin, and he lived in those places, right? So he didn't have to worry about it. You want one story here? I mean, how you doing?
Sure.
How's your attention? I just got back from Israel. I was living in New York City, and I was living with this actress friend of mine. And so she says, let's go to off-Broadway play this friend of mine. It's a one-act play. I said, sure. So we went, and it was a great one-act play. It would last about 45 minutes. So there we are at 8:45 with nothing to do. And I said, you know, Moshe's in town. Moshe Feligres is in town. I said, let's go visit him. You've heard about him. Let me phone him up. So he said, yeah, we're just here. You know, there's a number of us here. Come on by. So we walked in, and to be in relationship with Feligres meant that you sometimes have very animated, if not heated, discussions, right? So we went in the room. There was a TV on. There were several people talking. Moshe was carrying on one kind of conversation or another. And then he and I got in this very animated conversation, and then things were going on. And our friend looked at him. There was a certain moment where there was kind of a pause, and she looked at him. She said, you know, she says, you're a great actor. She said, I've acted with Duvall and Pacino, and she said, you are great. And he kind of looked at her for a second. You know, the room was very still at that moment, right? He kind of looked at her. And then it all kind of got, you know, a three-ring circus again. So afterwards, we were walking along, and she said, do people take him seriously? And I said, was I taking him seriously? She says, yeah. She says, I just hadn't seen that part of you. You know, I hadn't seen that side of you. And so she says, well, let me tell you. She says, look, he's acting. He said, inside, he's so neutral. She says, you people just don't see it. He's incredibly neutral in there. Oh, he's in his role. You know, when he's playing it out, she said, he's thrown himself into the role, but you don't see that he's incredibly neutral, right? So like a year later or 2 years later, he's given a workshop in New York, and she's walking by, and her cut's different, and she's dressed completely differently, and he's talking with a group of people, and he stops talking with her, and he walks over to her, and he takes her hand and says hello and says, you know, how's your acting career going? And they really remembered her, right? But it really gave me some insight that he had this capacity, like you're saying, to throw himself into all these different roles, but there was some of a solidity.
Or,
yeah, there's a core there that it was very, very solid and very generative, extremely generative. And so in that sense, I think, you know, I think that when people see the Amherst videos, they just seem kind of crazy acting out. But when I was in Israel, or when Mark and I were in Israel, I was there for 6 months, and I lived above his brother, and I was there, you know, morning, afternoon, and evening. And so you really see a whole different side of him, you know, and the way that he treated Mark and I and Ned Dwelly over there when we were working with him, he was unbelievably generous and gentle with our learning, right? He just, I mean, outside of the context of working for him and talking about the work and whatever, I mean, in terms of our actual learning, we've had discussions. It could be really turbulent discussions, but again, that was a sort of character development. But when we were actually working with him, he was incredibly gentle. And I think that people just, they don't see that side. They don't recognize, you know, that he had that side. Mm. I mean, you kind of see it when he's working, but you don't see it if it's not live, and if you don't see it, you know, 7 hours a day or something like that, you know.
Yeah,
so,
when he's not, you could say when he's not on stage.
When he's not on stage, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, that actually, I'm feeling very satisfied. I think that this might be a wonderful place to stop. Even though it's very cold outside, I think I'm going to, when we're done, put down the phone and take a walk around the block and sort of process all this. Would you be up to doing this again at some point?
Sure. Why don't you look at it or listen to it and see what you got, and if you have any more questions, email me and we can go on from there.
You bet.
Okay, bye-bye.